From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the summer of 2014 in Rochester, when the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County launched a new program aimed at bridging the divide in racial and ethnic backgrounds. The program was designed to bring people together and to do it in pairs, two people from different racial or ethnic backgrounds who would meet regularly over 9 months. They could talk about their own challenges and perspectives, and kind of meet in different ways to get to know each other, to understand each other, the hope being that after those 9 months, some stereotypes might be eroded, more perspective gained, more understanding might be achieved. That program continues 2 years later. It's called Person to Person. And in fact, the program is accepting applications for the next session starting in the fall. Later this month, Person to Person celebrates a graduation of sorts. And then there will be a workshop called Living in the Tension, the Quest for a Spiritualized Racial Justice. We'll tell you about all of those things coming up. And this hour, we've got the chance to sit down with some of the participants in the Person to Person program. I have a full, actually I have a fuller than full studio, a lot of different guests who've had experience with this program. Let me go ahead and welcome them now, as well as a guest on the phone. Jean Carroll's here. She's the president and CEO of the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County. Jean, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also here, Aaron Wicks is the director of planning and evaluation at Action for a Better Community, and he's a facilitator in the Person to Person program. Aaron, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Elena Nessio is here. Elena is a B2B marketing manager at Gannett and current participant in the Person to Person program. Elena, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
Reverend Michael Ware is here, pastor at Webster Baptist Church and a current Person to Person participant. Reverend, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Louise Spinelli is here, legal administrator at LeClaire Corona Giordano Cole LLP and a current participant in the Person to Person program. We're going to be trading mics around, but I'll wave and say hello. Nice to have you there, Louise. Thank you for being here. And on the phone with us is Shelley Touchluck. She's an author, and she's the keynote speaker at the upcoming Person to Person graduation. Shelley is the author of Witnessing Whiteness and Living in the Tension, the Quest for Spiritualized Racial Justice. Shelley, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, let me start with you, Shelley, as someone who has written on the subject of sort of racial tension and privilege and all of those things. When you see this program kind of from the outside, what do you make of it?
I think it's a brilliant program. What research demonstrates is that sometimes just coming into contact with someone who has been perceived as a stranger or another can actually heighten stereotypes. So this program, bringing people together for a continuous process to get to know one another deeper and underneath the sort of superficial ways that we often come together, I think is a wonderful effort.
Shelley, that is interesting I think more than a little concerning. You say that when we come into contact with people who are not like us, essentially, your first assumption would be that would be the first step to breaking down some of those stereotypes. Why does it occasionally do the opposite?
I think it has to do a lot with the superficial nature of those contacts.
Hmm, yeah.
We bring with us all of our lived experiences, our learned experiences, which has been often informed by a lot of media and the resulting implicit bias that comes with it. And so initial impressions can simply reinforce all that we're bringing to the table. And so it really takes actual solid effort to break down all that unfortunate conditioned racism that lives within so many of us.
Well, let me turn to Jean Carroll then for a little bit more of an overview on how this program works. And when Shelley says that a lot of our interaction may be somewhat superficial when it's from people who are not like us, I can't help but think back to the conversation we had on Monday on this program with Sylvia Mendez, who's just turned 80 on Monday. Most Americans have never heard her name. We know Brown v. Board of Education. We don't know Mendez v. Westminster, which happened 7 years earlier. Sylvia was a third grade student in Orange County, California in 1944, who was not allowed to go to the quote-unquote white school because her skin was too dark. She was of Mexican and Puerto Rican descent, and her family sued. The superintendent in court said that he didn't want Mexicans in the school because they have lice and they're unclean, and Sylvia's family won. It laid the groundwork for Brown v. Board of Education, and so I think about how what Sylvia told us on Monday was, we're still so, in fact, in many ways, we've resegregated. And so Jean, maybe that's a good way to kind of to line up your explanation for why you wanted to create why Person to Person came to be in 2014.
Person to Person really came to be because of the state of our community and the degree of segregation that exists in our community. And we at the YWCA provide services to women, many of whom are in poverty and struggling. And while we provide services to women of all races and ethnicities, more so women of color, and we see, you know, the services are critical, but being a voice and trying to bridge a divide between the two communities that we exist in, the two cities or the two communities, was really part of why we wanted to do person to person. You know, that interaction, that kind of just surface interaction doesn't do the trick. And the reality is that many of us know very few people of a different race. Many of us don't have any deep friendships or intimate understandings of someone who is of a different race or ethnicity. And it's unless you are able to go beneath that surface level and really have conversations about difference, you're not going to get there because you don't have an understanding. And I myself, I know on my journey of learning, you know, I didn't really get it. I really didn't as a person. So I understood. And Shelley's book, honestly, was extremely helpful to me in creating an understanding of how I was in my own way of being able to have a sense of how life is different if you're a person of color.
All right. So before we dive into Shelley's book, because she's with us for the first half hour, she's keynoting at graduation, which is coming up. When's graduation?
Graduation is coming up on June 21st at 5:30 at Temple Bethel. And we have 60 individuals graduating from our person program. And these folks have spent 9 months paired up with one other person to explore difference with that person, and also paired up with other pairs of folks in a group to have conversations on topics of interest, to dig a little deeper, to create greater understanding. And, you know, hopefully now they're ready to take what they have learned, the skills, the knowledge, into the community and use them in their own sphere of influence.
All right, so Gene and Aaron, what's the 1 minute snapshot on how it worked? You mentioned 9 months. If you're in person to person, you get paired up with one other person, and you're meeting how often? What's that entail? What's the minute description?
The minute description is you get paired up, you meet with that person at least once a month. You, every other month, meet with a group and have a dialogue with a group. About every 3 months, you get together with the whole 60 people and may listen to a speaker or a panel discussion. But it is a whole curriculum around race, ethnicity, and difference. It starts out easy, and then it keeps digging a little further so that hopefully by the end of that 9 months, you really have gotten to some of the root issues that exist in you as an individual and hopefully had some aha moments mm-hmm. as a part of the process.
I'm looking forward to hearing from some of the participants coming up on this program. Shelley Touchluck is the author of Witnessing Whiteness, who's going to be keynoting at their upcoming graduation. And Shelley, you heard Gene mention that in reading your book, she had a kind of moment where she realized she was getting in her own way. I'm curious to know, what does the author think she means by that?
I think she had the kind of experience that it took me 4 years of trial and tribulation with people trying to get me to understand. I think she had something of that experience. For me, I didn't have a resource like Witnessing Whiteness, and so I was extremely defensive about hearing that pretty much most of my thoughts and feelings about a lot of issues had assumptions in them that had been bred into me from a life lived without thinking about race. And so I have a feeling that that kind of story is exactly what I hoped for when I actually wrote the book, which is it shouldn't take that as long as it took me, and it shouldn't be as difficult. There are definitely ways for us to get underneath that sort of shame and guilt idea and move more quickly into an ability to be responsive to the fact that our unconscious minds are much stronger than we give them credit for. So I have a feeling some of that unconscious bias started to become alive and relevant to Jean, and at least I hope so.
You can read more at witnessingwhiteness.com of Shelley's work there and see some of the work that she has put out there. Whether you're picking up books, there's a blog there. But Shelley, you said there are definitely ways to start grappling with that and not take, you know, the years that you felt like it took for you and the Jean is sort of talking about here. What are some of those ways? What should we be thinking about?
Well, 20 years ago, there just wasn't a plethora of information out there specifically from white people giving their stories and their ability to offer that understanding. And specifically 20 years ago, it was very uncommon for white people to be encouraged to get together with other white people to help share those experiences and teach one another. So often what happens, and this is to some degree both the benefit and the curse of something like person to person, it requires a person of color to be present also to help support a white person to learn about these things. Now, the beauty of person to person is that I think the idea is that there's mutual understanding on both sides, and that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And there also need to be spaces, and increasingly there are spaces where white people are getting together to help educate one another. And so that can look like Witnessing Whiteness book groups. There's an entire curriculum that was crafted in partnership with the YWCA in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that's also available on that website. It's free. It's downloadable. It's the kind of thing where just groups of people can come together and walk themselves through questions to deeply investigate. If there isn't someone who feels ready to take on the challenge of leading that kind of discussion, there are actually radio calls that people can be part of. Surge is a network. It's called Showing Up for Racial Justice. Is specifically oriented toward white folks who are trying to work together to come together, learn in really healthy ways so that we can be part of racial justice. There are just innumerable books and videos now that are out there, and I could go on, so I'll stop now.
Well, Shelley, though I know in the work that you've done and the books that you've written, surely you have heard from readers who have expressed the same kind of things that we occasionally hear on this program, which is listeners who say, look, I'm white. I am not part of the generation that enslaved people. I would never have stood for that. And I feel like I'm being punished for the sins of the past, and I'd like to get past that. And why am I made to feel guilty about it? I know you've heard that sentiment. And how do you start addressing it?
Well, I think that there is a typical reaction that moves immediately toward guilt quite naturally, but I think that most people doing racial justice work aren't asking for people to feel guilty. I think there's a fear that they're supposed to be guilty. There is this sort of model, this way of being white that's really well understood, which is sort of that guilty white liberal. And I don't know that that's an attractive model for how to pull people into racial justice work. And most people in this work know that. And this is pulling from Beverly Daniel Tatum, who is the author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting in the Cafeteria Together? And essentially, she says, you know, there are a few models of being white. One is about being a racist. Most people don't attribute themselves to being racist. There's being a white guilty liberal, which is also not an attractive model. And then there's being unconscious to racism. Well, I've never heard anybody say they want to be considered unconscious in the world either. So what does that leave us with? And so there is another way of being, and that's where the idea for witnessing came from, which is coming from the legal standpoint of being able to stand up and say, you know what, I see this. I see what's happening. I see, yes, that there has been an entire history that has not been just, but that the systems that got put in place have not been 100% eliminated. And unfortunately, and being an educator myself, I can say this unequivocally, we do not teach the full scope and breadth of the trauma and the injustice that has been perpetuated over the hundreds and hundreds of years, and that still remains within our systems today. So until we get to a point where we're actually looking at the systems and not taking that system personally, we're going to have a hard time investing in undermining that system.
What's, you know, that is a, for lack of a better term, that's that comment that you just sort of laid out for us still remains abstract to people in some ways, that we have personal racism and then we have systemic racism, or we have structural racism. And you say the system remains in place, but give me, sort of lay out an example for some listeners to help them see, if they don't already, how the system perpetuates some of that.
Okay. I'll give you a reference, because the actual longer specific examples are much more complicated. But Michelle Alexander, in the book The New Jim Crow, does a fantastic job of laying out just how implicit bias within each individual, when as part of a larger structure of decision making and policy making, end up replicating these sorts of troubles. And so, for example, where are police issued to go and observe and patrol? A lot of times those are going into places that are highly populated by people of color, which is how we end up with a result where the population of kids of color who are actually being criminalized is multiple times, up to 20 times higher than white kids who, by all statistical measures, are doing the same activities of kids of color, particularly in terms of low-level drug use.
I suspect we could also look at the Brock Turner rape case in Stanford this week, with a lot of people who feel that the system enabled him to get a light sentence because the judge viewed him as a star athlete and a quote-unquote good kid who had been convicted, remember, of 3 felony sexual assault charges, and the judge didn't want his future to be impacted by a long prison sentence. And so this white, wealthy child, he's an adult now, I should say he's a child, he's 20, he's an adult, he gets a sentence that is shorter than some black or Latino defendants get for traffic violations. And some people may view that as an example. Do you?
Yes.
Simple as that. Okay. That was easy, Shelley. Well, before we let you go, Shelley, we got a few more minutes with you. Can you give us a sense for what you are going to talk about when you're here in Rochester later this month for the graduation of the person-to-person program?
Well, for the person-to-person program, I think I'm probably going to focus first on just sort of what that process looks like for how to carry forward. What does it mean when we've come to some realization of something that's new for us, and how do we stay engaged with that moving forward, bridging into the newer work I've been looking at, which is that tension that results for people who really are, and spiritualized. I also am looking at sort of that idea of being in constant improvement, the idea of us being invested in personal growth and that aspect of ourselves that's deeply, deeply human. How does that reconcile and work together with an effort to racial justice? And how is it actually sort of mandated that if we are going to be continuing to dig deep into understanding who we are and improving ourselves, how is racial justice work an essential component of that?
And Shelley, I want to ask you to kind of weigh in on where we are as a country. March 18th, I think, was the 8-year anniversary of then candidate and Senator Obama's speech on race in Philadelphia. He made that speech in 2008, shortly after there was that media firestorm, the tapes of Reverend Wright, and I think we all recall that time. And the president, again, then the senator, said, he touched on where we could go as a nation and sort of the fork in the road, and this idea that that racism, systemic and personal, has been real and a part of our history. But he also knows that that we have an opportunity to start healing and moving forward. Well, 8 years later, there are times where it feels like we made progress, and there are times where some people feel like we have not at all, or we've gone backwards. How do you feel?
I think both are true. I think that there are absolutely ways that we can statistically measure that we've been going backwards. When we look at the resegregation of schools, for example, I mean, the rhetoric that is so prevalent within our society now is just horrifying, quite frankly. And the fact that, Southern Poverty Law Center has issued, reports that indicate that the number of hate groups in our country has exponentially increased since the election of President Obama. And so we absolutely have been backsliding. And in the last 10 years, I have seen more conversation about race that has been useful, that has opened people up, that has caused people to stand up and say, wait a minute, there's something to be done here. I think that that realizing on the part of many people is also a positive thing. It doesn't erase the backsliding, but I think we have to look at both.
Jean Carroll is president and CEO of the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County. You talked about the impact of Shelley's book on you. Did you feel any of that guilt? Shelley says the point is not to just guilt shame people, but how did you feel when you kind of grappled with some of what you read?
I felt like I just didn't really know. You know, I'll give you an example of, I would be at a restaurant or going to a restaurant with a friend who was a person of color, mm-hmm. and we'd be waiting, and other people would, for instance, get in before us. And the person of color would say to me, I see what they're doing. We were here first, but these other people are more important than us, so they're getting in. And I was like, I would be like devil's advocate. Well, maybe they had a reservation, maybe there was some reason why they did it, as opposed to just understanding that this person had different experiences than I did, and that their experience was something that I should be listening to. So rather than listen, I automatically went on the defensive about white people, including myself and including the people who own the restaurant. So part of the process is opening up your ears and your eyes and really having those conversations so that you have a greater understanding. And, those kinds of things are, we're so much into just the facts, And this is not just about just the facts. It's also about the feelings. And, feelings really often drive what facts we choose to focus on.
All right, Shelley, got to let you go, but final thoughts from you. Do you feel like your work's making an impact when you hear Jean talk about the impact on her?
I'm just so grateful anytime anyone picks it up and finds it useful. It feels like to whatever degree it contributes to something being beneficial makes me very, very happy.
Shelley Touchluck's the author of Witnessing Whiteness, among other things, and you can find her online. You can also find her in Rochester. She's coming later this month as the keynote speaker for the person-to-person graduation. Shelley, thanks for taking the time, and we will see you here later this month.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we're going to meet some of the participants in the person-to-person program that we have been talking about. Back in just a moment. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, people who oppose abortion generally also oppose criminalizing the act, even if it's banned. In other words, if we ban abortion and a woman has an abortion, people who oppose abortion don't think that women should have criminal penalties. And a panel is going to explain why, particularly in the light of recent comments by politicians. Then second hour, previewing the Jazz Festival. Talk with you Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Person to Person is a program initiated by the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County back in 2014, and they're rolling on. It's a program that now moves into, I guess we don't go by years, Aaron Wicks, who's one of the administrators. It's 9-month sessions, right? That's correct?
That's right.
Okay. And you're accepting applications starting in the fall, is that right?
Yes.
How did people do that?
I think the application is available through the YWCA, who is coordinating the program. I think they can get that online. They could probably stop by in person.
Okay. And as one of the facilitators in this program, Aaron, how do you hook people up? How do you decide this person with this person? You know, how does that work?
Well, there's a real effort made to try to match up people that that are of different races, but might also have some commonalities. Generational commonalities, or sometimes professional ones, mm-hmm. Because you don't want too many differences to be part of the conversation. You really want there to be some common ground going in. And that seems to have worked fairly well.
Okay. You've got, I think the number I heard mentioned was around 60 graduates. Is that right? So how many people total, I don't know if you have an exact number, but how many people in the last couple of years have roughly have gone through this program?
Well, I think it's over 100. 150. No. I think there was a larger number in the first year.
How many can you accommodate starting in the fall?
80. I think we're looking for a cohort of 80.
Okay. So there you are. And the program is person to person. They've matched up two people. You heard a little bit how it works, but let's talk to some of the participants. Louise Spinelli is here, a legal administrator at LeClaire Corona Giordano Cole LLP. She's a current participant. Hi again, Louise.
Hello.
Elena Nessio is a B2B marketing manager at Gannett and a current participant in the program. And Reverend Michael Ware, pastor at Webster Baptist Church, also a current participant in the program. I'll just kind of go around the table. I'll start with Louise here. How did you get involved and why in this particular program?
I was formerly with the Monroe County Bar Association, and our former diversity committee chair, David Tang, nominated me. And when he brought it up, I was very excited. I had been part of the Monroe County Bar Diversity Committee and a clerkship program for a number of years. So it was, to me, I saw it as a continuation of that and more on a personal level.
Okay. Reverend Ware, how did you get involved?
Well, I was actually recommended by our regional executive minister to take part in the program. And out of that, he had been a participant himself and had felt it very rewarding and very refreshing, and said, you know, Michael, I think this would be something you would really enjoy being a part of. And certainly he was correct. It has really been a very good experience.
Okay. Elena?
So I was nominated by a colleague, Suzanne Perrone, and she felt that I would benefit from it, from a personal perspective, because it was of high interest for me.
And?
It's been wonderful.
You started when?
I started, it was just about 9 months ago.
Okay, because you guys are just about getting ready to graduate. All right, so I'll ask each of you to kind of walk me through how it has gone for you. I'll start with Elena then. It starts in what way? Are you getting together for coffee? Are you getting together in different settings? How does it work?
Sure. So for Luis and I, it was easiest to get together for coffee. So I would joke with some of my colleagues, I was, it's a great way to start the day. You're talking about some pretty heavy issues. But frankly, for me, the benefit was that, you know, we could do it in what felt like a lab environment. We had enough common ground that we felt comfortable very quickly with one another. But then, we had some pretty difficult questions and conversations that we were trying to work through. But being able to do it in what felt like a safe environment. Ironically, we were doing it at a very public place. And so sometimes I admit, you know, we kind of looked around to see, is anyone listening to this? Because they might have, you know, some questions about the conversations we're having. But it was, it was a really invigorating kind of way to start the day, frankly, but then also to carry it through and think about it as I was at work, even, versus if I had done it perhaps in the evening, I might have gone home and wrestled with it. But being present and having it persist with me was always really interesting.
So, Elena and Luis, you're meeting for coffee. Are you getting to heavy stuff pretty quickly? Did you try to get to know each other first? What was the approach, Louise?
We did a little bit get to know each other, and we did find those similarities. But the YWCA provides some structure, some questions that we're supposed to discuss. Mm-hmm. And, we did go off on tangents. But right away, we did delve into those questions. And, I think where we kind of blocked an hour of time, they usually ended up being probably more an hour and a half, as with the group sessions as well, because I think we were just also interested and involved that we didn't want it to end and be limited to that time frame.
Elena, what were some of the questions then that were either suggested questions or you thought important questions that maybe weren't part of the script?
Sure. So we talked at length about, you know, how race was introduced to us and how it was discussed in our homes, and some of the things that were perhaps taboo or unacceptable, and how that persists now within our families, and how we deal with it. And it was always interesting to me because we had such different backgrounds, and yet there were some issues that, you know, they'd come back up and we'd think, well, how do you address, you know, racism with an older uncle or a cousin or a family member and do it in a way that's constructive and positive and engaging for them, but also still, you know, recognizing that you've grown up in this environment. And so those were always interesting for us. And I think that's probably where we got off on the most tangents was when we started talking about families and, and dealing with these things at home.
What would you say, Louise, you learned about Elena that is most valuable?
You know, I think we both have a deep, genuine interest in pursuing this. And the family experience, and now that she's raising children, and what that aspect is like for her versus when she was growing up, and just her awareness of that and trying to, you know, for her children, but kind of making that better place for our local environment and doing that through her children.
Elena, what would you say you learned that you think is most valuable to you?
I think Louise's experience, you know, she talked about her parents and where they grew up in the city, but then also some of the experiences they had as, you know, first-generation Italians. And I'll be honest, I didn't quite understand the degree to which they had experienced, you know, racism and
prejudice.
And prejudice, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so for me, that was really eye-opening. You know, a conversation we were having in the lobby was around the idea that a lot of folks who are white don't necessarily identify themselves as a race. They don't think of that first and foremost, whereas you might think, well, I am Hispanic or I am black. Rather, they don't necessarily identify as white. And so we were talking about this. And I think for me, that was starting to be dismantled with this conversation around, you know, one of the things that Louise shared with me, and it stays with me so much, but there was a sign in Niagara Falls, and it was effectively equating Italians with dogs. And I remember when she shared the story with me and it said, you know, no dogs and no Italians. And it was so impactful. I mean, I've brought it up multiple times because it hit me so hard. And I had never thought of it in that capacity. You hear about other, you know, other ethnicities, you hear about other races having that kind of experience. And yet, you know, we think, well, Italians are white. And so they don't have that kind of an experience. And yet, for me, that was really eye-opening and beneficial in understanding that, you know, there are a lot more layers that even I'm not aware of.
You know, I talked about Sylvia Mendez earlier this hour, and in 1944, there was a no dogs, no Mexican sign on some of the local theaters in Orange County, California, and some of the local shops and restaurants. So what an ugly part of our past. But I didn't know. Again, I agree with you. I didn't know. I should have known, but I didn't, that Italians also experience that. Let me also ask, can I ask a blunt question then?
Sure.
Because
sure.
Sometimes we've got to be blunt, right?
Yes. That's what we learn in
We have to be real about this.
Be real.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I think what Elena is describing is an important understanding that just because someone is white doesn't mean it has always been sort of simple or easy or super privileged for their own background and family and ancestors. I do think it's a little different now. I mean, do you think now, Louise, for a lack of a term, is it Louis C.K. said it's easier to be white. It's okay to say.
Oh,
it.
Definitely.
Do you disagree?
I mean, the white privilege definitely exists. You know, and what my parents went through in the 50s, first coming to the United States, and housing discrimination and job discrimination, is certainly different. You know, having white skin, we've been able to assimilate far easier than other ethnicities and races.
Yeah, Elena, have you felt prejudice? You know, have you experienced it yourself in your life?
I haven't very often. I've witnessed it, mm-hmm. but I haven't felt it as much directly. And I think for me, it's because I'm able to do a little bit of the code switching, and I can blend, and I feel as if sometimes I can fly undercover. And so where I grew up in the city, so I grew up in a very ethnically diverse neighborhood, and so I identified more often with people of color. But I was part of the urban suburban program, and so I attended school in West Irondequoit. And so my peers looked very different from me, and yet I blended in. It wasn't as if they could look at me and immediately know, oh, you're being bused in from the city. And so it put me in this interesting position where, frankly, I didn't feel that I connected with either group very well. But I got this understanding, and I was able to, again, be a little bit more of a witness in seeing how folks, interacted with one another. And yet I wasn't necessarily directly a recipient of any type of prejudice or any type of, recognizing, that I was Hispanic. It was interesting for me, though.
And you used the term code switch, which NPR listeners may be very familiar with that, or maybe not. NPR has done a lot with code switch, NPR code switch online, and very interesting both social media discussions and elsewhere. But how do you define the term?
So I define it, I think about, so another element that I'll share in terms of my background, my father moved to Tennessee when I was 8 years old, and so I spent quite a bit of time down there. And so the way that I talked when I was in the South, some of the attitudes that I would embody, the way that I carried myself or presented myself, I would change so that it was easier for me to assimilate or to blend in with the folks that were around me versus when I was at home, living in the city in Rochester, or when I was at school in Western Rondequoit. So it was more about, adapting the way that I presented myself, the way that I talked, the way that I articulated, the way I carried myself, some of my actions, so that it was probably the best way to put it is maybe with less friction for my environment.
Do you regret the idea, though, that you almost, if you're with a mostly white audience or mostly corporate audience or whatever it is, that you have to sort of code switch and make sure you're in their language and you're not, I don't even really know what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Is it unfortunate that you feel like at times you have to code switch, or is that part of life?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, part of it is inherently it helps with being more effective and more successful. But I think I regret that it's a skill that I've learned to master.
See, that's what I mean. Like, Louise, if I were having coffee, like, these are the moments I'd go, I mean, this just, it's an amazing thing to think about that experience in life.
Yeah, and, while I'll say I'm Caucasian and Christian, I shouldn't say always surrounded myself, but I'm intrigued by people of other cultures and races and religions. As one friend of the family put it, he's an older gentleman and went on my Facebook page and said, "You are like the UN of Facebook." and to me, that makes life more interesting. And so Elena was just another component. I shouldn't say just another component of that, but it was a very interesting aspect in addition to what had already experienced in my life. I have very good friends in New York City who are Chinese. We would often go to only Chinese venues, and I would be the only Caucasian person there. Mm-hmm. Through our clerkship program, I would, be with African-American and Hispanic students, and again, the only Caucasian person there. So some of this program is a continuation of that, and the nice part with Elena is that it's become more personal, and we plan on continuing that relationship and the dialogues.
Did you grow up, Louise, with a family that had a lot of friends from a lot of backgrounds? Is that something that you developed for any particular reason yourself, an interest in making sure that you didn't just sort of insulate in a bubble?
Yeah, I mean, one of the similarities Elena and I have is that we actually grew up on the border of that Irondequoit in the city, and it was very culturally, racially, ethnically diverse. I had Jewish friends and African-American friends and Ukrainian and Italian, and it was very mixed. And when I was about 13 years old, we moved to Wayne County, which was very white Christian. And even at that age, I thought to myself, what has happened here? Segregation, I thought segregation ended. So it was, and at that point, I felt more like probably like my parents felt, because it was like, oh, wow, you have an accent, and oh, your parents are from another country. And it was just, I felt very the stigma of being different, but yet proud of being different. I embraced my my heritage, and I'm very proud of that and getting to know others.
And before I kick it over to Reverend Ware, then let me just ask Elena then, 9 months program, long enough? How do you feel about the person-to-person program?
I'm disappointed it's ending. We've been talking about how we might continue the conversation personally, Luis and I, but then also as a group where we can continue to have these conversations. You know, I'll miss having, you know, that safe environment to have. You know, they're difficult conversations, but they're important and they're meaningful. And I really value having the opportunity to have them.
Well, I suspect Aaron Wicks, who is a facilitator of the program, they would not be the first pair to continue a relationship after the 9 months.
No, absolutely not. The initial group of participants have formed an alumni group to continue their work. It's going to welcome this next group in and grow. And the YWCA has done a great job of providing all participants with additional resources, opportunities to continue both their conversations as well as translating those conversations into social justice work in the community. So the momentum that's developed in that 9 months can continue down an interpersonal as well as an institutional and community-wide path.
Let me just get one quick question before I ask Reverend Ware about his experience. Jake wants to know, what's the general makeup of the participants? Not just race, but economic and political differences can be just as important to share. Aaron?
Well, I think I would say that the participants are disproportionately higher educated. They tend to be professionals, upper middle class types. However, I do want to note that that's how they often appear when they get together in our group discussions. But what you find is that beneath those surface characteristics, there are very different life experiences, and so a lot participants have a wide range of experiences, religious and economic experiences in terms of their background. I think the only thing that should be noted is that these participants are doing this voluntarily. So you obviously get a very different dynamic when you have people in the room who genuinely want to be there and want to explore. I don't know how this would work if you just threw people into a room together. Probably it wouldn't work as well. But other than that, I think there's quite a bit of diversity.
I hope you haven't had anyone leave the program then, because it is volunteer, as you say. Have you had anyone quit?
The only experiences that I know of in that regard are people who are just unable to make the commitment, because it is a commitment to develop a relationship, to meet fairly regularly. And there have been a few individuals who have just said, I can't make the commitment.
Yeah, but that's different than saying, this is not working, I don't like doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, I've seen nothing like that.
Let me get one phone call as well, and this is Ed in Rochester. Go ahead, Ed.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I'm personally concerned about, and have been for a long time, that the dialogue between the races in this country. I'm 52 years old, and I remember in college having a conversation with a good friend of mine about black and white and the differences and just the dialogue. And I made a reference to him at one point. I said, you know, the civil rights movement in the 60s really did not leave the impact, the lasting impact. And he kind of thought that I was a little bit off base from that. And if you take a look at kind of what's happened over the past 30 years, it seems like we've been moving apart and people are afraid to engage in dialogue. And unfortunately, we just seem to become more entrenched. And there's not a conversation between the races, especially between black people and white people in this country. And when you take a look at, I think, the segregation, I think that's continued in Monroe County, you still see, you know, just the concentration of people of color in the city and people not of color primarily in the suburbs. And it just seems like the country is not, we're moving away from each other. We're not moving together. And I really look for a conversation that where we can kind of get back together without people being offended. I guess that was my main point here this afternoon.
Well, Ed, thanks for the phone call. Reverend Michael Ware is the pastor at Webster Baptist Church, and he's a current person-to-person participant participant. He's in the program now, going to be graduating soon, right?
Yes.
Well, first of all, what do you make of Ed's comment there?
The first piece for me is that I do think, and I would maybe argue a little bit, that indeed the civil rights movement did leave a grounding. I think what obviously ended up happening was there was a sense in our country that we just kind of let the conversation go aside. And for quite a period of time, that indeed is what's been happening. The issues haven't gone anywhere. There's continued to be very strong racism in our country. The civil rights movement was in my mind, a beginning. And as in movements, it had its beginning. And then there was this period where it settled. It just sat. And whether it was leadership, it was part of our country. We were very much involved in the Vietnam War, and there were so many other issues that were being done in the country. And indeed, we continued to have blinders on what was actually keeping us apart, which was the poverty, which was poor educational system, which was the housing market that made sure that we only lived in certain communities, which was still very prevalent and very much going on. So behind the scenes, and of course we had our war on drugs that all of a sudden pushed us to this plateau of placing young black men and young black women in prison. So the incarceration rates rose so high that it was almost like, okay, we're dealing with this issue over here, and we'll just not even acknowledge the fact that we're no longer having a conversation about race. And I believe one of the things that's transpired and has always been going on behind the scenes, there's always been those who have been wanting to speak up in some way and somehow about the issues of race in our country and around and within our communities. Those voices have been, as I call, grassroots conversations, which have always been going on. I believe one of the things that re-sparked us as a country, and unfortunately I was in South Africa when this started, was the Black Lives Matter movement, which re-engaged us in a conversation, not from the old style of conversation, but from the young millennials who began to create this sense of conversation, and where you found young blacks, Hispanics, whites coming together on a movement that has now re-engaged a conversation that has always been going on, but it never got the voice that it needed to continue. And as a black man, I have always been very aware of the sense of race from a child to an adult. I remember working here in Rochester as a salesman, and I remember going into certain communities where, as a black man, I would come up, and this is not in the 60s or 70s. This is not even in the 80s. This is in the mid to late 90s, and as a black man coming to your door as a salesperson, sometimes I was invited in, other times I was not. So very aware that we've been wrestling with this issue and continue to wrestle with it. And that is one of the reasons why I'm been excited about being a part of the program, because I do believe we have to have dialogue and conversation. And in this case, with what we're doing in this program, I believe, is we're having dialogue conversation in a way that we probably wouldn't have. My partner and I, Dan, probably would have never met in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are having this conversation and finding out the commonalities and finding out the experiences, just as these as has been shared with you already, about how you start this program. And you start off with just, hey, how are you doing? What's going on? And so let's share a little about your experience, about your experience. And next thing you know, You're quickly not talking about the shallow stuff. You're quickly getting very in depth with one another about your own experiences and being able to share those experiences in a way that can be life changing, and also can be ways where the other individual can see where you're coming from, that they never saw it before. So that would be my answer to that. That the conversations have been going on. But because of the way we've set our society up in the sense of the way it's progressed, it's as if these conversations have not been happening.
Yeah.
But they are.
Well, and so you already covered some of your experience there, but I got a couple minutes left, so let me just ask you, what do you think has been the most valuable aspect of participating in the person-to-person for you, Reverend?
Two things for me, I think. The number one, it has been the exposure of meeting Dan and having these conversations and just sharing honestly about our experiences and also agreeing that when this program is over, that we're going to continue to meet and to be a part. We're going to continue to meet individually, irrelevant to what happens next. The other piece for me has been the conversations I've been having with other people about the program. Because it's like, so you're doing what? And you're going with who? And you're having this conversation about. And so when I'm letting people know this is what I'm doing, I'm doing this, I'm volunteering to be in a one-on-one conversation with someone about race. And there's no subject that's taboo about it. There's nothing that we won't talk about. There's nothing that we won't connect with. And so those are the two things for me. Just having a partner that we'll continue relationship with over race, and also be willing to, I think the third thing is that we're willing to now to try to advance that conversation outwardly. And continue to support what is going on with this program, because it is important for us in Rochester to continue to have these conversations and then to take these conversations and expand them. One of the things I was saying to Gene as we were coming in, I was saying that one of the things that Dan and I have been wrestling with is how do we take this conversation to the high school level, to the junior high level, to the elementary school level? Why are we waiting until, you know, how do we bring this program sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I think it's good. Well, at the very least, you tell people, sign up for the fall.
Sign up for the fall.
And they're taking applications for the fall. They'd like 80 people to do it in the fall. They've got 60 people who will be graduating at their ceremony later this month in the person-to-person program. And regular listeners of this program know I've got a real affection for programs like this. Maybe you remember the conversation we had with the group that does the regular salon, people who are opposed to abortion and those who support at least the allowing abortion. And obviously abortion is a hugely sensitive issue and they disagree so strongly, but they met and they're friends and that kind of thing is so positive. And when you've got a country that is increasingly segregated, I think asking people who have different backgrounds to come together can be beautiful. So Gene Carroll, congratulations on that. You want more information? Gene and Aaron Wicks, where do people go if they want to learn more and maybe sign up for the future? Where can they do that?
You can go onto our website, or you can call the YWCA at 546-5820 and ask for Sharon Parada. She is our coordinator for the program. And, you know, we do have these events on the 21st, yep. And also on the 22nd, there's another event, which is a workshop, which would really dive you in. And our author is going to be promoting that along with greater Rochester community churches.
You can sign up now. Call 546-5820. More information or jump online. Thanks to all of our guests. Thank you all for being here. Great way to end the week. John Andrus, the engineer. Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a great weekend, and we'll talk with you Monday.